From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A new study published today concludes that casual use of marijuana, once a week use, can lead to previously unidentified changes in the brains of 18 to 25-year-olds.
In a moment, we'll talk about drug treatment for high school students right inside the school building.
But first to that study, a collaboration between Northwestern University Medicine and Massachusetts General Hospital Harvard Medical School. It was published in the Journal of Neuroscience. Hans Breiter is a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern. He was senior author on the study. So, Professor, to your findings, you say the casual use of marijuana changed the brains of young people. How so?
Well, basically, we looked in at two critical structures for reward processing and judgment decision-making, and also the processing of emotion. And we found that these two structures were abnormal in these casual users compared to well-matched, healthy controls.
Well, tell us more about these parts of the brain. We know about decision-making and things like that, but the part of the brain that is involved in reward processing, what does that mean?
A fundamental aspect of addiction research has been this concept of reward, and that substances of abuse basically kind of hijack this system and substitute for things that are naturally rewarding, such as food or playing with your kids or taking a moment to read a piece of Proust or something. Since early work in the 90s, we've found that the nucleus accumbens is basically one of many, many regions of the brain that process what is positive and negative for a person and facilitate making judgments and decisions based on these assessments of what's positive and negative.
So in other words, this does something to the part of the brain that might be triggering the need for more and more use of something like marijuana to feed that part of the brain, the reward part of the brain?
Yes, and in fact, the animal work that's been done shows that the nucleus accumbens does change our work by showing that the volume, the density, and the shape of this region of the brain changes and relates in a dose-response way to the cannabis, very much in parallel with what's been seen with animals.
Well, and you used MRIs to compare the brains of these 18 to 25-year-olds who reported smoking marijuana at least once a week with those who had little or absolutely no history of marijuana smoking. But there are questions about the research because we understand very small study, only 40 young people, 20 who reported smoking pot casually, 20 who didn't at all. Is that really enough people to come to a conclusion? And these young people did self-report. I know that there was psychological testing to back up their claims, but how can you be sure?
This is an excellent question, and it's a question that gets raised in any type of study where you take a sample of society and then try to extrapolate out from it. We used statistics that allow for a random effects analysis. We looked at the data in multiple ways. I myself am known as being a bit of a conservative neuroimager and don't publish things unless I believe it's going to be replicated. But it gets to this issue, how can you extrapolate from 40 people to the rest of society? You can't. This is a pilot study, absolutely needs to be verified with larger cohorts and in cohorts across the country. There's no way with just 40 people that you can sample the diversity of a country with as much diversity as we have.
Well, what do you think this does say, though, just on the face of it, to marijuana legalization advocates who argue that marijuana is safer than alcohol? Now, we know that previous studies, as we said, looked at the brains of heavy marijuana smokers and saw some effect there, but this is casual use. So what do you say to people who say casual use is much safer?
I say to them that this is a shot across the bow, that we need to actually study this more. By showing that there's abnormalities in the brains of people who use casually, we've indicated that there's something not right with this piece of folklore.
Hans Breiter, professor in psychiatry and behavior sciences at Northwestern Medicine. He's also senior author on the study, which appears in today's Journal of Neuroscience, on the effects of casual, very casual, marijuana use on the brains of young people, a study in collaboration with Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School and published in the Journal of Neuroscience. Professor, I'm sure you've got some conversations started. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, ever since recreational marijuana became legal in Colorado in January, some school officials say they are seeing more students using it. They also say that heavy weed smokers generally miss more class and get lower grades. So now one high school outside Denver is offering a drug treatment program right alongside biology and Spanish. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine reports.
Dr. Paula Riggs is on a mission, and it's because of one number. A number that shocks her. The drug abuse researcher says only 10% of kids who need drug treatment are getting it.
That's a crazy number.
That 10% who get treatment mostly end up there by court order after a run-in with the law.
But the 90% who could benefit are in our high schools.
So in high schools like this one, 10 to 15% of the students around me are heavily dependent on drugs, usually pot.
They have cannabis use disorders, cannabis addiction, and there's nothing in the schools for them.
Except here at Adams City High in Commerce City.
It's a pilot program, what Dr. Riggs says is the first evidence-based, school-based treatment program in the country. Riggs is the director of the Division of Substance Dependence at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. The district and Riggs's colleague recently got a grant to adapt an existing treatment model to work in schools. Riggs says a big problem with sending teens to outpatient programs is they can't afford it or they don't show up.
So we thought we've got to bring it to the school, provide it on-site, bell-to-bell in the school for those kids who get in trouble with drug and alcohol-related school offenses.
So here's how Riggs' treatment works. If a teacher suspects a kid is high, a radio call goes out.
Security to the clinic. We have a student under the influence. I need to bring for a substance evaluation.
Then this guy,
Darren Dunson, senior,
gets involved. Dunson is a dean at the school. The kid is searched. The nurse does an evaluation. Parents are called. Dunson, a former Marine, has a way with kids, and usually they fess up. Instead of suspending them, which is what would normally happen, he offers them a chance to stay in school and attend the treatment program called Encompass. Dunson says hosting the program in the school makes sense.
For a lot of kids, this is their safe place, this is their home. And I think that inside your home, you should have some kind of support system to help your child when there's a need. And that's what we're doing.
If a kid says yes and their parents agree, they get a comprehensive psychiatric and substance abuse evaluation. Dr. Riggs says heavy marijuana users often suffer from depression, anxiety, or ADHD, among other psychiatric disorders. Therapists need to know what they're dealing with.
Our studies have shown that it matters if you have depression when you walk through the door of drug treatment, because if that depression doesn't remit, your drug use, even if you stay in treatment, is not likely to go down. So you got to treat them both together.
Encompass uses cognitive behavioral therapy. Over an 8-week session, kids learn how their thoughts are connected to their behaviors and actions and try to shift to more positive and useful ways of thinking. Here's Dr. Riggs discussing that with a 17-year-old girl.
A lot of kids just don't know how I'm feeling affects how I'm thinking, and then that affects how I use. You mm-hmm. just think, I just use.
Yeah, that's what for the longest time, I was like, I'm just a pothead. That's the deal, is that I'm just a pothead. But now I understand, like, I know that. It's because when I feel something depressed and, like, it's like, oh, go smoke weed. And it's like the craving. It's like almost like how your stomach tells you that you're hungry. It's like telling me I need to smoke. So I'm just understanding how to, like,
be
aware with it.
The therapy teaches young addicts how to gain control over those thoughts. Teenagers are at the developmental stage where they're just starting to move from the concrete to the abstract. So therapy focuses on specific skills to practice, where kids can see a lot of changes in a short period of time.
So what a typical session looks like, it's really very structured. So
therapist Erica Herman says each session starts with a student reviewing his or her work. Did they get into any high-risk situations that made it hard to stay clean? How did they deal with it? They go over coping skills and how they can practice them at home. Students get to draw for prizes if they've done 2 pro-social activities that week, like cooking or playing basketball, or if they have a clean urine analysis.
And then they also get additional draws for consecutive negative urines.
Then the meat of the session. The student chooses a specific skill to work on: anger management, regulating negative moods, coping with cravings. they identify triggers for smoking weed, feeling stressed out, a fight with parents, maybe a party.
So we spend a lot of time in this therapy just helping the youth understand why they use.
This can be tough because teenage brains are under construction. Adolescence is a time when kids are learning how to problem solve, manage emotions, and communicate. As they develop those skills, the brain changes, wiring them in for life. But if kids start using drugs as their main coping skill,
eventually their brain becomes conditioned to any time they feel that negative emotion or any time they want to celebrate, their knee-jerk reaction is to use drugs. And so then it just becomes a habit where that's what they do all day, every day. And so you might be working with a 15-year-old who's operating at the developmental level of like a 12-year-old.
Some kids who arrive at the Adams City High program aren't ready to quit marijuana. They say there's no problems in their life. Herman has to meet them where they are. If she pushes them to change, they'll shut down. So she listens carefully for little openings, like when they say they won't be smoking pot when they're 30 with a family. She'll ask why, and soon they'll be telling her things that the kid realizes applies to his or her life now, like, I want to be motivated and focused.
If you join them, it's so fascinating to see how fast you can actually see somebody move through those stages of change.
Results from the first round of participants in this pilot treatment program won't be ready until next month. But both Herman and Dr. Riggs say doing treatment in schools appears to catch kids before they're at a really severe level, and they're able to make changes more quickly. Riggs says two similar treatment centers in Denver high schools are expected to open next fall. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brendine in Denver.
So, treatment in schools. Yesterday we heard about parents who have drug test kits at home. This is all provoking a lot of response. You can weigh in at hereandnow.org. Some other stories we're following. Hundreds still missing after that ferry carrying mostly high school students sank off South Korea's southern coast. Secretary of State John Kerry is due to meet in Geneva tomorrow with officials from Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union to talk about the crisis in Ukraine. And there's a new study analyzing online reviews of thousands of restaurants on Yelp.com. What does the study tell us about us? These and other stories later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now, and it is April 16th, which means it is the day after tax day. And if you had to pay taxes yesterday, you may be wondering where all the money is going to go and how much you might get back. Well, Washington Post opinion columnist Catherine Rampell recently sparked a heated debate about government social spending when she wrote about who benefits most and who really pays for it. She's with us now from Washington. Catherine, welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, let's go back to your original column on social spending that touched off this debate at the Washington Post. Tell us what you said in the beginning.
I wrote about a lot of research that was done by Robert Moffat at Johns Hopkins University, in which he has looked at how the social safety net has changed over time. He's basically found that in raw dollars, we are in fact spending like four times as much money per capita on social safety net spending today as we were in, you know, let's say 1970. And he considers the social safety net to include everything from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Earned Income Tax Credit, food stamps, basically any kind of social insurance policy, as well as means-tested benefits that are, you know, basically anti-poverty programs. So he found that, yes, the social safety net has expanded. We are being much more generous as a nation when it comes to the sort of social spending. But he also found that there are winners and losers in that greater expansion of the social safety net, that actually the government is being much more generous to middle-income people and sort of the near poor, people who are slightly above the poverty line, than it is to the very, very destitute.
And that's in part because of programs like Social Security and Medicare, which benefit everybody no matter what you're making.
Right. So it's partly has to do with the fact that those two programs that you mentioned have grown tremendously, partly because of demographics, right? We have a lot more old people today and they're living much longer. And so to the extent that, you know, the government has to spend more money on them. That's going to eat up a larger share of the pie, the social safety net pie. It's also partly driven, to be fair, by some other policies that have deliberately rewarded kind of the working poor as opposed to the jobless. So we've seen over the last couple of decades a huge decline in, you know, what used to be called welfare payments, you know, for like single mothers who couldn't find work. And we've seen a big increase in payments that reward people for working, like the earned income tax credit.
And you got a lot of response from readers when you wrote that, including one that you started your next column with, which said, "Sorry, spoiled millennial expletive, but seniors have worked and paid for their Social Security and Medicare."
Yes. That was one such irate email, but I got plenty of them. You know, the point of the original column was just to talk about and kind of explain how the social safety net and how Americans go about, you know, supporting and subsidizing other Americans, how it's changed. And I kind of had that one paragraph, maybe it was two, talking about the demographic issues and the fact that Social Security and Medicare represent a bigger share of the whole, you know, welfare state pie today. But that section really touched a nerve. I got a lot of angry emails like the one that you cited saying, you know, you were ungrateful and you're entitled and how this is just, you know, a conspiracy to try to steal the elderly's hard-won benefits that they have already paid for in full, and how dare you try to take it away from us.
To which you responded what?
I don't usually write back to people when they use swear words, but in this case I did. I said, "Thank you for your email. I'm thinking about writing about this in my next column. Would it be okay if I actually quoted, you know, use your name?" And she wrote back saying, "Absolutely not." So I just quoted from the email without attributing it to a specific person's name. And I wrote about how actually this premise that older people have already paid for their benefits in full is completely wrong. That it's very common, but it's completely wrong. Yes, they paid taxes. They paid Social Security taxes. They paid Medicare taxes. But first of all, those taxes went to pay for their parents' retirement and health care benefits. It's not like they were sort of held in a special account for each individual worker. You know, you pay in the tax and they get paid out almost immediately to fund existing retirees. And besides that, even if you're just looking at kind of the arithmetic to see how much should I contribute to the system versus how much am I taking out of the system, it's actually quite a good deal for seniors. Generally speaking, for like the retirees who turned 65 in 2010, they're getting out in Social Security payments roughly what they paid in, but they're getting much more in Medicare payments than they paid into the system, which is a function of both Medicare taxes being way too low to ever cover the cost of expected benefits, and also healthcare costs rising dramatically.
And it means that younger people, people in Generation X and millennials, are the ones who are going to be working and paying into the system to pay the benefits that the boomers will be getting as they go into retirement. You are a millennial, and I was looking at the average age of members of Congress. It's 62 right now in the Senate, 57 in the House. This is not a new argument that you're making, but it doesn't seem like it's getting a lot of traction in Washington.
Certainly not. I'm not sure it has so much to do with the age of the politicians themselves, although I'm sure that doesn't help, so much as their constituents. Older people vote. They vote in much higher numbers than young people. So it's very dangerous to talk about changing the system. And even the proposals that you've seen in Congress that have talked about reforming, like the Medicare system, you know, Paul Ryan got a lot of praise a couple years ago when he put out a proposal for like a block grant Medicare program, or at least capping payments. You know, those won't touch people who are, I think, already over the age of 55.
Right.
So it's very dangerous to talk about ways to reform this system.
Well, as you looked into this issue, is there anything that could be done, do you think, that would be seen as fair by people who are at retirement age, people who are near retirement age, and people who are younger and at working age?
I don't think you're ever going to be able to appease all of those parties. I think what you can do is you can try to find ways to bend the cost curve, as the term goes, with healthcare spending, because that's really what's driving the huge increase in entitlement costs. It's not going to solve the demographic issues you have, where you have a very large cohort of baby boomers who are being supported by a relatively smaller base of working age people.
Right.
That part is very tricky. I don't exactly know how you do it without actually threatening to cut benefits. You know, taxes are going to have to go up if we're planning on keeping the promises that have been made to current and future retirees.
Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, and we've got links to both of her articles at our website, hereandnow.org. We'd love to hear from you about this when you go to hereandnow.org, or you can send us a tweet at hereandnow. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, rarely, Robin, is there a story that impacts everybody, but right, that one certainly does, and we all felt it yesterday. For those who paid taxes or got refunds, it touches all of us.
As you said, send your thoughts to hereandnow.org.
This is Here and Now.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And after a brief glimpse of spring, parts of the country have snow on the ground again. This morning, baseball players in Chicago last night played in 30-degree temperatures. Winter still with us, claws out. This hasn't been good for the U.S. housing market, and there are other problems as well. So let's bring in NPR's economics correspondent, Chris Arnold, covering housing and the economy for us. He's in the studio. And Chris, I understand we got new numbers today on home construction that were disappointing.
Right. Now, the number of new homes that builders started construction on rose a bit, actually, over the past couple of months. But the couple months before that, it crashed really hard. So the long-term view here is that we're about 6% below where we were a year ago. Mm-hmm. And by other metrics, too, the housing market's been slumping. So this is starting to make some economists nervous. They say, look, the recovery's already been frustratingly slow. This is the general economic recovery. Wages are flat. Job growth's been anemic. A healthy housing market could do a lot to help create jobs and boost the economy, but we're just not seeing that right now.
And when you say, you know, you talk about a slump, can you quantify that for people?
Yeah, so the pace of home sales has fallen in 6 of the past 7 months. And that puts us back to where we were 2 years ago in terms of the pace of sales. That also means we're down about 15% off the peak. So that's kind of gives you a sense of where we are. And as we said, construction's down also. So that means fewer jobs are being created. So things are definitely moving in the wrong direction, not the right direction.
Well, and we mentioned weather and, you know, you can't do construction in weather. But why else might things not be moving in the right direction?
A lot of this has to do with just basic supply and demand and prices and things like that. So a couple years ago, you probably remember we had really, really, really super low interest rates. Mm-hmm. And people like me were refinancing again and again to take advantage. That drew a lot of people into the market because we also had very low prices. And this was post-crash. Now, what's happened over the past couple years is people buying up those homes that were out there. That's pushed up prices. There were also investors who came in and pushed up prices. And as that has been happening, stuff was going on with the Federal Reserve and the economy's been recovering. So interest rates are now rising too. And that creates a double whammy. So prices are higher, interest rates are higher. All of a sudden, people were looking at houses are thinking, wait a minute, I'm not sure I can afford the house that I thought I wanted to buy. So that's part of the problem.
Well, and you also say the credit has gotten tighter.
Right. And this is definitely an issue that some of the and this goes back to those investors who came in. A lot of them were using cash, whereas they've now kind of they're pulling back from the market because those crazy deals aren't there anymore. And now so what we need is or what the housing market needs is what it's always needed is just regular middle income Americans to come along and get a loan and buy a house. And so now that credit's gotten tighter, a lot of economists say that's keeping people who should be able to own a house, making them unable to own a house.
OK, well, so tight credit and all these other things that you mentioned. But go back to weather. Does this mean if weather is playing a big role, does it conversely mean that as the weather gets better, we might see more of a rebound?
That's what the realtors are hoping for. And they always hope for that. If you have friends who are realtors, they always say, well, this summer we really hope things are going to get better. So we'll see. What we do know is that at some point, we just have to start building more houses, that the U.S. population is growing. People have been living in their parents' basements. Supply is tight. So whether it's this summer or next summer, at some point, we're going to have a lot more guys with nail guns framing houses and putting roof shingles on again, and that just has to pick up.
Music to your ears. NPR's Chris Arnold, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. On this day a year ago, Bostonians got one of their first glimpses into the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing the day before when emergency room doctor Ron Medzin came on our program. Now, 13 area hospitals received 180 patients. ERs turned into MASH units. Dr. Medzin, head of medical simulation at Boston Medical Center and a professor at Boston University, told us they heard a squawk on their disaster radio, then nothing, then all hell broke loose.
The first patient rolled in. He was near death. He had lost both of his legs, and we started to work on him. And then it was just one after another after another. And there really were literally at least two patients I took care of had minutes left. One of the women I was talking with, who also had a really bad leg injury, was telling me that she was a competitive dancer. And I mean, there are no words.
Well, she was begging you to save her leg.
That's basically what she was doing, yes. And you know, I think that they were able to save her leg, but I really don't know. I'm really proud of the job we did, and I would certainly, personally, if I have the chance next year, I want to be standing in that spot watching the marathon next year. Honestly, I think they picked the wrong city. Boston EMS is one of the finest EMS services in the country.
Doctors were not able to save Adrian's leg or Jeff Bowman's two legs, but they did save lives. What has it been like the year since? Ron Medzin, again of Boston Medical Center, joins us in the studio. And how are you? I mean, trauma is what you do, but this was an attack on the city. Does it stay with you?
It does, yeah. It stays with me. It's not on a day-to-day basis, but once in a while, especially the staff I worked with that day, we'll start talking about it. And all of a sudden, you know, I feel this constriction in my throat, and we can sort of, tears kind of start to well up, and I realize that I'm certainly not over it.
Yeah. We know when our colleague, who was your wife, Here and Now producer Karen Miller Medzin, mentioned to you that we were speaking with Jeff Bowman, which we did this week. What was your reaction?
What's interesting is not only do I have sort of a visual and emotional memory, but I even remember sort of the smell in the room. Excuse me. It was very much like the smell of a fire victim or, you know, a fireman coming in from a fire. I could smell there's burning flesh, not to be too.
No. I mean, Jeff Bowman talks about that he could not figure out what this odor was that was triggering so many physical reactions in him. And the first time he took a shower, he realized the odor was him. Your wife told us that when she showed you the picture we took of Jeff when he was here recently, you looked at it and your first reaction was, I can smell him.
Yeah, I can still smell it.
It sounds like there's a little bit of, I don't know, post-traumatic stress or something maybe in you, do you think?
I would say yes. I wouldn't ever believe that that was something that would happen. I mean, we see trauma. The day after the marathon bombing, we had 10 penetrating trauma victims at Boston Medical Center, so it was business as usual. So we see this all the time. But there really is something. I saw some coverage this morning. Some memorials, and it really grabs me.
Yeah. Is the hospital doing anything to sort of help you guys through this week?
It's done things all year. They've had open meetings with social workers.
And are people taking advantage of that? You know, you guys are tough stuff, but are people saying, yes, I do?
Oh, yes. A couple hundred people showed up just the first week after the bombing to the session. It was a lot of tears, and it was really, I think it was cathartic for a lot of people, so.
Yeah. Well, but there's also so many wonderful stories. You watch Adrian Haslett Davis. She's pledged to dance on Dancing with the Stars. When you see that, what happens?
Oh, I'm obviously really happy for her, but I still can't help but feel, you know, I think about what's happening in the background, all the pain, all the work, all the rehab, and it can't be easy. So she has to live with this every single day.
Well, and then there's John Odom. You mentioned two patients who almost died.
He actually, you know, lost his vital signs several times in the emergency department in the operating room before they finally Saved him.
And now he launched the one run on the West Coast that ran from California back to Boston and wrapped up just this weekend. That's a life that was saved that day.
Yeah, that is pretty incredible. It's a good feeling.
Not one life was lost once these horribly injured people, over 180, got to the hospitals. Not one life.
It's incredible. It's incredible. There is no other word to describe it.
So, are you going to be at the finish line?
I absolutely am. I'll be very proud to be watching the people pass, all the BMC nurses who are running to raise money for BMC. And just
Boston Medical Center. You should say you've got a team out there.
Yeah, yeah. We have a number of nurses are running. My wife is running for BMC, so go team.
Yeah. I can hear the excitement in your voice. You want to be there at the finish line, but is there a mix of feelings?
Oh, there's absolutely a mix of feelings. I mean, there's also just a small percentage of dread as mm-hmm. well. I mean, I don't know. You know, who knows what's going to happen? And I've already mapped out my mind how I'm going to get back to the hospital if ever bid something else happens. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Will it help to have this year behind you as much as you want to be at that finish line?
Oh, I do think that'll help. Yeah. I mean, time does heal, but this is big.
Ron Medson, Director of Emergency Medicine and Medical Simulation at Boston Medical Center. We talked to him a year ago today after the bombings. And by the way, after that, you heard from so many people. Was it overwhelming to get response from around the world?
It was really nice. It was really touching. Yeah.
Yeah.
When we had done this interview last year, I came out of the office and I was walking into the atrium and there was a pizza delivery guy. He looked kind of lost. So I just walked up and said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "Yeah, I have some pizza." I said, "Well, who are you supposed to deliver it to?" "This Boston Medical Center." And I said, "Well, who's it from?" He said, "It's from Texas." And I thought, "Oh, that's for us." I think it was a Here Now listener. So shout out to the Here Now listener.
It definitely was. They called us, and I think you got like 20 pizzas or something from
great.
Texas.
And good call on the jalapenos, by the way.
Dr. Ron Medson of Boston Medical Center, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
A reminder that our listeners rock. Again, Ron Medson, emergency room doctor and director of simulated medicine at Boston Medical Center. And by the way, while Boston's emergency services have been applauded and their work that day a year ago studied by other emergency rooms, they also learned from doctors caring for victims after the theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, 6 months before the Boston Marathon bombings. We'll link you to that story at hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Okay, time now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
Joining us here in the studio is Christopher O'Reilly, host of NPR's classical music show From the Top. He is also a well-known pianist himself. Christopher, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you wanted to talk about a group called The Bad Plus. What should we know about them?
I met them in Istanbul many years ago. I was playing at the jazz festival there, and then we went to Club Babylon and saw a late show. And there's this jazz trio, Ethan Iverson, pianist, Reed Anderson, bass, and Dave King on drums. And I just remember seeing them and having Ethan declaim the first verse of what turned out to be Black Sabbath's Iron Man. They've primarily been famous for covering pop bands, but they're each in their own right fantastic composers. And I just fell in love with them from that point on. I would go so far as to say my girlfriend, who, if anything jazz-like appears on my iPod, it's instant fast-forward time. But The Bad Plus, she loves. And so they each bring a disparate energy to the band, and they all also bring a different compositional voice to the table. So now they've become more famous, not just for their covers of of David Bowie and Blondie and Neil Young and Nirvana and all these other guys, but they've also, you know, covered Stravinsky and Babbitt and Ligeti, and now they've come out with The Rite of Spring.
Well, and let's not just talk about it. Let's hear it. I want to first hear the original Stravinsky Rite of Spring performed here by the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. Okay, and now let's hear Rite of Spring by The Bad Plus. What do you like about what they have done here?
Well, I think there's a certain condensed and intensely pressured idea about doing this piece in shortened, in straightened circumstance. I think I find more excitement in The Rite of Spring playing it on one piano than I do listening to the orchestra. I just think there's something to be said about having an economy of means with that kind of fusionary energy about the piece.
It sounds more dramatic in a way.
I think so. I mean, it's more personal.
They have also covered the Hungarian composer Gheorghe Ligeti, the piece Metal. Let's first listen to the original. Okay, now let's listen to the version from The Bad Plus. So you're saying your girlfriend would like that? She'd let it play on the iPod.
She would totally let that one play, you know. And I just think that piece is tailor-made for them because, you know, you have Dave, who's just the most incredible drummer I've ever heard, and just the way he turns a typical drum set into a real orchestra. And he's got kids' toys that he's playing in the setup, and the way they're so synchronous, it's just terribly exciting to hear them play.
Bad Plus has not just covered some classical music, but also Nirvana, Aphex Twin. Let's listen to the cover of Flim by Aphex Twin. And Christopher, we should say, people that listen to Here and Now regularly probably hear this a lot because we use it as a music bed.
Oh, you do you?
We do.
Good for you.
So we've heard that one before, but tell us about it.
Well, I'm a big Aphex Twin fan myself, and I think what Dave does is incredible because the drum-like sounds that Aphex Twin uses, you know, Richard D. James, the sound it's almost double-timed or quadruple-timed. I mean, because he just kind of wallows in the technological, and so Dave does his damnedest to really keep up with that sort of frenetic, inhuman energy, and it's a real tour de force for him.
Well, Christopher, we can't have you here without talking about your music just a little bit here. I want to listen to you doing Radiohead's Paranoid Android. The original song is great. Your version is brilliant. What draws you to doing something like that, though?
The two things that draw me to playing any kind of music really are, first and foremost, a sort of a sensual harmonic sense, you know, chords and harmonies that really get under your skin and make your skin tingle and things like that. So that's number one. Number two is really a compelling sense of counterpoint, a weave of voices that you'd have, let's say, in a Shostakovich fugue, or with, you know, Radiohead's music, which is, despite the fact only one of the guys in the band reads music, all five always contribute one thread to each song. And so that weave really is a compelling way of me getting into a piece.
But are you trying to showcase something that someone who's listening to the original version would not notice themselves?
I think there are things about the music that I play that I think the piano is really good at illustrating. Mostly the texture. I mean, the way that the piano has of having a different texture for each piece. Like when you listen to a great Robert Schumann song, the accompaniment is always so different. I mean, the harmonies are not, you know, revolutionary, but there's something very particular about the musical texture that's absolutely married to that particular piece. And so I think a lot of what I'm doing with these arrangements is trying to get all those eggs in one basket and also, you know, show what the piano can do.
Christopher O'Reilly is host of NPR's classical music show From the Top. We'll have his complete list of music at hereandnow.org. Christopher, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
And we're listening here to the Bad Plus version of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. Blurring the lines between classical, jazz, rock and roll, all of it. We've got all of the songs from today's Here and Now DJ sessions at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art. New shows on view now by artists William Kentridge and Nick Cave, ICABoston.org.